welcome to episode 64, which is two to the sixth power, Jason.
Wonderful.
Of Up and In the Baseball Perspectives podcast in sunny DeKalb, Illinois. I'm Kevin Goldstein. Joining me, as usual, and from DFA in Mexico, it's Jason Parks. Jason, say hello to the internet.
Howdy.
Got a good show for you. Jason's playing through pain. We'll get into that a little bit later. We'll do a ton of email. We got many, many good emails from you. So we're going to do a little more email, a little less baseball talk. We'll talk about why we don't have much baseball talk, because there's not much to talk about.
Right.
We're going to talk about why September is going to suck. We're going to talk about there's been a lot of Twitter mania over MVP and what makes an MVP and who you vote for MVP. I just want to go to that really briefly. And then there's also been a lot of Twitter mania about Arizona Fall League rosters. And I want to get into those for a little bit. And not necessarily – we'll do more of a league preview before the Arizona Fall League actually starts.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about why we're not going to do one now and why you need to calm down about the Arizona Fall League. And we love the Arizona Fall League, but you got to calm down. Our special guest is Juan C. Rodriguez. We have another Juan on the show. It's our third Juan guest. And Juan is the great beat writer for Florida Marlins for the Sun Sentinel. And we're going to talk about baseball in Florida because it's kind of fascinating. The Marlins baseball, what can that work? And Juan's going to tell you some stuff that I didn't know, and it surprised me. And you know what? Maybe baseball can work down there. We'll see. But we'll talk about what's going on there now. We'll talk about the new stadium. We'll talk about why people go, why people don't go. Get into the Logan Morrison thing a little bit and stuff like that. It's good fun to talk with Juan Rodriguez, good friend of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll do the goof stuff, talk about our musical guests, some adventures from Mexico, and we'll wrap things up.
Jason, sounds good.
So it's time for your favorite part of the show, Jason.
Indeed.
If you want to email us, keep the emails coming. And I got to tell you, this was your finest week, my listeners, as far as your emails go. You email us at podcast@baseballperspectives.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I am @Kevin_Goldstein. Jason is at Professor Parks, currently with an – who's your avatar? Is that – that's not Messi. That's Puyol or something?
Puyol.
Yeah. He's a soccer player, folks.
Puyol, yeah. Plays for Barcelona. His hair is very moist all the time, always wet.
If you want to do the Facebook thing, you do the Facebook thing. You go to Facebook and you look up and in and you do the Facebook stuff. You can get T-shirts and mugs and drinking stuff. Links to that's on the Facebook page. And that's about it. Real quick update on a couple of things that we talked about on the show that have nothing to do with baseball. We got a lot of really great reaction to the interview with Ranny last week about Syria. We'll read one of those emails later. But there's been some changes in Syria since our discussion. It seemed for a while on Sunday night that something was really going on, but it was more of just a small change in the sense that, you know, when we talked to Ranny, Damascus, the capital of Syria, had actually been quite quiet throughout this process and kind of controlled. And there started to be protests, sit-ins, strikes, and work shutdowns, and things like that are now happening in the capital. The government's still cracking down on these people. There are still people dying every day. But there has been at least some sort of step forward, or at least a step in the right direction. There have been reports of some army defections among the army, who people do will not kill the people. And so, you know, things are not looking up in Syria, but things are looking more up than they were before. We also talked about Monterrey with Juan a few months ago, and you know, nothing good was happening in Monterrey. It was kind of quiet. Then it was violent and angry again. But last week, there was a pretty horrendous incident in Monterrey where the gang, the Zetas, basically threw hand grenades and gasoline into a casino and killed 50-something people. And it seems like it was kind of a shakedown situation where they asked the casino for the protection money, something went wrong, and they blew the place up. 53 people, folks. And
Civilians.
These are not people who are part of the drug war. It's not like you. In a lot of ways, the people dying were part of the drug war, and it's, you know, nature part of doing business, and dangerous and everything. But if you weren't in the drug war, maybe you were a little more safe. But this was just random people, and it makes you think, if they would do it to a casino, why wouldn't they do it to a grocery store Juan shops in? And the only good thing coming out of that is that they're actually investigating this one hard and working hard, and they've arrested some people already. There's been I talked to Juan this morning, and there are photos have come out of the mayor of Monterey, his brother, taking money from the casino. And it's getting uglier and uglier there. So as we do every week, our best hopes for Juan.
I'm going to see Juan on Saturday.
You're seeing Juan this weekend, are you? I knew he was coming to Mexico City.
Yeah, we're going to get together.
Excellent.
Yep.
Let's get to our emails. Our first email is from Daniel. Daniel's in Austin, Texas, and Daniel prefaces his email by letting us know he will be experimenting with different nicknames for the two of us.
Okay.
Dear Goldenrod and Professor Magic.
Goldenrod.
Patron Gold Thousand. On last week's show, you were asked if we could wait till Alex A. from Toronto wins something before we anoint him the Messiah. Taking the conversation away from Alex, do you think that a GM needs to win a World Series in order to be considered the best GM in the game? Do you think that a player needs to win a World Series to be considered the best player in the game? I've always been a you can control the process but not the results guy. Well, yes, you control the process but not the results, but you still have to win something because that's your results. If you're a GM, if you're an individual player, you have these individual stats. If you're a GM, your stats are the win-loss record. There are obviously great GMs who never won a World Series, but I don't know if there are great GMs who have a career losing record. I don't know if there are great GMs who have never had a winning team. And so, I don't think Alex needs to win a World Series for us to start talking about him as a great GM, but I do think he has to have a winning season. I think he has to compete for a playoff spot at some point. He needs to get into the playoffs at some point. You can't lose and constantly get praised. And his next question said, JPHD. Since you can't sign United States players until they graduate from high school, is there any point in scouting them before they turn, say, 16 or whatever? I can understand needing to build relationships early in the international market, but with the draft, does seeing a player earlier matter? Can you glean useful information from watching a player's development between the ages of 15 and 17 that you can't glean from just watching them when they're 17 and 18?
Well, I mean, watching them when they're 15 through 17, I mean, yeah, you will see players do that. But building the relationship is important, too. You know, you may not have the opportunity to draft them, but building a relationship with the family is still important. You don't have to start that early in the amateur market in the United States as opposed to in the international market, because that relationship carries a lot more weight. You know, the earlier you get in on those players, the more established the relationship can become, the greater the opportunity you will have to sign that player. You know, obviously in the Rule 4 draft, you have to, opportunity has to present itself. As far as like watching a player when he's 15 to 17 as opposed to, 17 through 18, I mean, you're not going to have a chance to draft that player between 15 and 17. Seeing how that player develops can be important. Obviously, the more thorough the scouting, the better it's going to be. But, when you're looking at an amateur player that's Rule 4 eligible, I mean, you only need to go back so far before, to get your scouting report. I mean, going forward, you're going to be basing it on what that player did when they were a junior or senior in high school, as opposed to what they were doing when they were freshmen in high school. You know, if they were Latin American players, you could be looking at what they were doing at age 15. And that's, a year away from when you can actually sign those guys and get them into the developmental process. You can't get these kids in until they're 18. As I said, establishing a relationship with the family is important. That goes without saying. Of course, because of the structure of the draft itself, you have to have that opportunity to draft the player.
That email was from Daniel in Austin. Our next email is from Austin in Chicago. And Austin says, I know that command and control are different skills, and I know that there are quite a few pitchers with good control but mediocre command. But I've wondered if the opposite is possible. Is it possible for a pitcher to have strong command but subpar control? Presumably, someone with this combination of skills would give up a fair number of walks but would compensate by racking up a lot of strikeouts, limiting home runs, or getting hitters to make weak contact that results in a low batting average on balls in play. I would think that it's possible to have mediocre control with good command. Tim Lincecum and Craig Kimbrell would be good examples. What other pitchers, whether established major leaguers or prospects, would fit this definition? Better yet, are there particular skill sets or repertoires, like mediocre fastball combined with a wipeout slider, that work better when the pitcher keeps the ball out of the strike zone and yields more walks? Love the podcast. Hope Jason doesn't suffer through too many more rolling blackouts. Jason, this is kind of a philosophical question. Can you have good command if you don't have good control? My answer is no.
No, you can't. For me, just by the definition of it. I mean, this is cookie cutter here, but by definition, control is the ability to throw strikes. Command is the ability to throw quality strikes.
Right.
So I can actually see it where, you know, a pitcher with really good command is nibbling. You know, he knows how to go to that outside corner and he's not getting it, but he keeps trying. He keeps putting the ball where he wants. It's not getting called. And so I can see, you know, that resulting in some walks, but you know, just by definition, if you're loose within the zone, that's the control element. But when you're fine within the zone, that's the command. If you have good command, you can put the ball where you want. You know, so you're not going to be walking a lot of guys for sport.
And let's talk about your two examples of guys who you thought might have that in Lincecum and Kimbrel. When you have Craig Kimbrel's slider, your margin for error on the pitch is enormous. It's thrown so hard with so much break that even when he misses with it, he's going to get swings and misses with it.
Right.
Because it's such a good pitch. He's not commanding it at all. He's just wheeling it out there and knowing that people are going to miss. The scouting term for those guys might be more of effectively wild than having plus command. You cannot have command if you don't have control. You can't. It's like having Texas chili with beans. You just can't do it.
You can, but just don't do it in front of me.
Next email's from Matt. Oh, Matt's one of the children who came to the bar. And Matt says, it's hard to go a day in August without hearing about a waiver claim. And it is, today is August 31st. It's waiver claim day. We've already had a minor deal. Many of these claims have a 0.5 to 0% chance of being traded. Is there a purpose for this at all? Is there an actual price tag on Pujols when the Tigers claim him? Are the Mets just trying to test the waters on David Wright? Aren't claims supposed to be unknown except to the team that wins the claim? Can you offer some insight to all of this?
Most of those house salary guys are put on waivers.
Because you want to see if someone's going to go nuts.
You want to see if someone will take a big contract off your hands.
Right, it costs you not. That's the thing. If you put your guy on waivers and the team claims them, and you talk to the team for 30 seconds, and you realize they're not going to give me 18,000 million things for this guy, and you pull him back, and you lose nothing, and you really didn't waste any time. You know, to put him on waivers, you had to, you know, send a fax, and to talk to the team that claimed him is going to take you about 30 minutes for the initial conversation.
I mean, wasn't Manny Ramirez put on waivers like 10 straight years in his prime?
Absolutely. I mean, everyone gets put on waivers. Yeah. So you are kind of testing the market, but more you're kind of seeing if you can win the lottery. And it rarely happens. But, you know, every once in a while you get a deal done. We saw Matt Diaz go to the Braves, back to the Braves today. We have another waiver question. This one is from Juan. We have another Juan. It's Juan Ramon, and Juan is in Panama City. And he says, first-time writer, no point niner, but I've listened to your show for the past 10 episodes. Welcome, Juan, and welcome from Pat to all of our fine listeners in Panama, which would be Juan. Two questions, one fairly superficial, one deeper. From listening to episode 63, the superficial question. It's fairly clear that your episodes are conducted over the phone and or intertube lines. That means you guys are not in a studio or even in the same room together. To the extent that this hasn't been answered, do you guys dress up or dress down for the show? I just wear what I'm wearing normally. It's usually night.
We record late.
Yeah.
So I'm usually casual.
Jason usually has his PJ pants on.
Yeah, my scrubs.
And so, but I think, yeah, we just dress like we're at home. That's all. I don't wear a tie. The deeper question, back to the waivers, are teams informed of every claim that is made for a player that is placed on waivers? I realize that teams eventually find out about the team which is awarded a claim, but are they also informed of every team that submitted a claim for the player, even if not awarded? The answer one is yes. Yeah, you are. You know, let's take Wandy Rodriguez for example. Wandy was claimed by the Rockies, who were awarded the claim. So Houston learned that the Rockies were awarded the claim, and they could try to work something out with the Rockies. But Houston was also told of every team that put in a claim for Wandy. Everybody gets to know those guys, you get to know everything. There's no secrets there, and so it's another way to kind of test your market on these players. Next email comes from Tim. Tim's in Portland, Oregon, which is like a foreign country as well. And he says, hi, guys. I enjoy your work on the podcast. I was listening to your conversation about Logan Morrison's demotion, and while I don't want to rehash that, I'm curious as to what you think his future holds. I'm interested in the scouting perspective on him because his development pattern confuses me. His first season, he showed really good contact and on-base skills and limited power other than that of the doubles variety. This year, he seems to have sold out contact for over-the-fence power. Which one is real? Or is this a typical pattern for a young player working on different components of his game? What does the crystal ball say? To Kevin's point about earning the right to have that platform, can Lomo be the kind of player who's good enough to get away with the off-the-field antics? Jason, you got thoughts on Logan Morrison's future?
I actually think he makes a good point about how young players do kind of, when they come into the league, he came in with a certain type of approach. And yes, some hitters in their second, third seasons do end up trying to sell out a little bit more for power. And as a result, you'll see, diminished contact rates, higher strikeout rates, et cetera. I think he's kind of an in-between guy. I think he'll go back to being the type of player he was in his first season. I see a guy with, more contact and on-base ability than over-the-fence ability. I think that's where his skill set is better suited, personally. And to the final point about can he be the type of player that's good enough to get away with off-the-field antics? I mean, I think so. I think it depends on the team. I mean, and we get into this when we talk about the Marlins, but personally, I think the Marlins could use a guy who can be the face of their team, can be a bit outspoken to get people interested in going to see baseball in Florida.
Right.
And if Morrison can be that type of guy, even if he's, not a superstar, which he's not going to be, yeah, I think that's a positive thing. And I don't really think his off the field antics are as bad as some people think they are. I
Don't
mean,
either.
it seems kind of minor.
I think Morrison has the ability to be an above average player for his position, and one of those guys who is like the best player on the Marlins, and then at some point when he gets traded to another team, he's just another cog. A nice cog to have, a good player, but it's one of those, we see those guys all the time. Think about Hunter Pence. I mean, I know, and I realize Philadelphia's fallen in love with Hunter Pence, but Hunter Pence, best player on the Astros, goes to the Phillies, and he bats sixth or so, or fifth. He's just another piece of the lineup there. He's going to be one of those kind of players, but a very good player nonetheless.
Sure.
Next email comes from Justin, and Justin says, I think when writing an email to the podcast, you must declare your status as a point niner or not, and I have to say I'm more than a point niner. Not only have I been listening from the beginning, but I went back and listened to around 40 episodes
Oh my
again.
God. Wow. Want.
The reason is that I was commuting from St. Charles to Chicago on the train. Hey, I'm on that train sometimes, which is about 1 hour and 20 minutes each way. Further, my employer allows me to listen to whatever I want all day, and I was able to listen to the backlogs again. It was actually pretty cool going back and listening again, mainly because the Padres collapse of 2010 happened, and I learned a lot of stuff I'd forgotten about. I have to move back to St. Charles from Chicago for a few months, so maybe I'll go through the entire series a third time. I also got my girlfriend sort of hooked on the show. While driving one day and playing the podcast, the 20 to 80 scale came up. She asked what it was. She had questions about the scouting terminology being thrown around, like ceiling and makeup, and now uses those terms and the 20 to 80 scale to rate our meal when we go out to dinner, among other things.
Keeper.
Yeah, my girlfriend doesn't listen to the show.
I don't listen to the show.
That's true. Besides my boring life, I do have a question regarding the White Sox. It's frustrating that as a team, they have no money. They have no money spending money in the free agent market or take risks in giving major deals to Cuban players, but they refuse to spend money in the draft. I realize this has a lot to do with Jerry Reinsdorf and his close relationship with Bud Selig, but when Addison Reed is your best prospect, your organization's pretty much fucked, right? Further, what do you see happening beyond
Right.
this year, with the leaders of this organization? Do they let Ozzie go to Miami? Do they promote Kenny Williams and promote Rick Hahn? I'm a desperate White Sox fan who's getting tired of explaining to Sox fans why Alejandro Diaz is not a prospect. And he's not. As always, thanks for the great show. And Kevin, I wish you were on every week with Boers and Bernstein on 670. Don't let me know, Justin. Let them know. I'd be happy to do it. Let's talk about the White Sox here. And you nailed it. Is there a reason that the White Sox don't spend in the draft? You nailed it, because Jerry Reinsdorf's really close with Bud Selig. The number of teams that are willing to follow the stupid ass slot recommendations is down to about two, and the White Sox are one of them. And there's nothing you can do about it. The Braves follow slot, and the White Sox follow slot. But now think about it. Braves always have a good system, don't they? White Sox haven't had a good system for a long time. So it's not just about the money. It's
The
about.
Braves know how to draft. They know how to acquire talent in all
And
markets.
then, yeah, so the Braves have a pretty impressive scouting and player development operation. The White Sox don't. They have not drafted well. They have not done well in the international market, of course, and they have their own problems internationally, but there are scandals as far as guys over there keeping money, which has given them a bad name in the international market. It's going to take a while and a whole lot of work for them to reestablish themselves as trustworthy in the international market. So they're in a bad spot. As far as the future goes, I think Ozzie's gone. And that's probably for the best. I think he's kind of worn out his welcome. I like Ozzie. I think he's a good manager. I just think he's not a guy who can be your manager for a decade. And so Ozzie's probably gone. The fun question now is there have been some whispers of late that Reinsdorf is looking into making Han the GM because he so does not want Han to go to the Cubs.
Well, I mean, would Han be a better GM than Williams? That's the only thing that really matters there. That's the only question that
Yeah,
matters.
no, you're right, but I have no idea. I think Kenny Williams has turned into a pretty good GM as far as managing a major league team. I think he's, I think the White Sox remain a poorly run organization in terms of developing talent.
That's got to fall on him then. I mean,
Yeah.
if you're not winning at the major league level, which let's face it, I mean, they're competitive, but they're not winning at the major league level. I mean, and without the sustainability that comes from a farm system that can augment that major league talent with young talent, young cheap talent, I mean, he's got to go. He's got to fall on the sword there.
Our next email is from Kevin. Kevin's in Korea. It's a very international flavored show so far.
It is.
And Kevin says, I've often wondered when I've gone on trips or been in foreign countries, I live in Korea, or just somewhere remote, if what I'm listening to is the first time that that band, podcast, poet, or whatever has been listened to in that geographic locale. I'm pretty sure that most of the places I've listened to the podcast outside of Seoul, someone beat me to it. Well, 2 weeks ago, I took a trip to Poland and looked at this as a perfect opportunity to expand the BP imperialistic flag. While finally cracking and counting backwards the upper 20s, I'm currently down slash up to episode 27, and while flying, the flight tracker episode played. I missed the flight tracker. That was one of my favorite nights of all time. I can now
That was
proudly
a
tell
great
you
evening.
the podcast has been played over Chinese, Mongolian, Russian, Latvian, and Polish airspace. As well as Poland, Krakow, Warsaw, and all points in between via the railroad. You're all very international. My question has to do with the player to be named later. How does this work? Is it dependent on how good the player makes the team trades the player to be named for his new team? Is there a list of options like the list of the side items at Boston Market? And if so, which team chooses? Well, let's talk about that. When you make a trade for a guy to be named later, you tend to have there's an agreed upon list. And the team agrees. If I'm trading my guy to a team, I give them this, them get guy, and I get the prospect I want back. And just because we got to get the friggin' deal done because of the deadline, they've given me a bunch of options. We'll give you one of these six guys. I go, okay, I'll take one of those six guys, but I don't want to make my decision right now because it's August, it's July 30th, and I don't have enough information. And so, in general, you will. Scouts will go out. You'll send your special assignment guys out. And they will go look at those six guys, and you'll pick one of those six guys. And at times you make the bad call, sometimes you make the right call. But you think about the right calls. A good example of the right call: the CC Sabathia trade when he went from Cleveland to Milwaukee. They had a list of players named later. They went and sent their scouts out. I have a pretty good idea what the list looked like, and they definitely picked the best guy. They ended up taking Michael Brantley. And then there's other bad deals as well, but generally you have a list. The player to be named later is there's you have an agreed upon list when the trade's made, and you send your scouts out and they pick a guy. It's not dependent on how the new guy does with his new team. It's not some sort of wide open thing. It's pretty much scaled down. You know what that guy's going to be.
Right on.
Right on. Our next email is from Jeff. Jeff says, "My name is Jeff, and I'm writing you from the beautiful city of San Francisco. I
It
don't
is a
usually
great
write
city.
to podcasts, but a series of odd events have compelled me to do so. Until very recently, I was afflicted with a series of illnesses requiring a lot of time of recuperation. After several days in bed with a stomach issue, I felt good enough to leave the house and get some work done. Unfortunately, my stomach really began to hurt after getting home later that evening, and after downing a bunch of over-the-counter medication for the pain, I was passed out in bed by 7:30 p.m. The downside of sleeping that early was waking up at an insanely early time. I woke up at 2:30 in the morning. I physically felt fine, had no idea what to do, was fully rested, so going back to sleep wasn't an option. But it was also too early to start my day. To kill a few hours, I grabbed a copy of the 2011 Baseball Prospectus Handbook and headed over to a nearby Starbucks that's open 24 hours a day. Although the baseball season is almost over, I still like to periodically thumb through the handbook to see how well the prognostications held up. I do that as well. The Starbucks was unusually busy, mostly occupied by police officers and students. The lone exception was a guy at the adjacent table who took notice of my book. We struck up a conversation, where he eventually asked me if I listened to the Up and In podcast. After answering that I did, he asked me if I was a point niner. For the record, I am not, although I don't look down upon those who are. I don't have the time or bandwidth to listen to every past episode. In any event, the guy at Starbucks again started chatting about minor league baseball. Isn't this nice, Jason? People just meeting up because they love the show.
It's wonderful.
Apparently, he had spent 4 years watching minor league games for a job. He said something that was repeated a lot around the time of the draft. He said that amateur players have a realistic chance of making the majors are taken only in the first 5 rounds. The players taken between the 6th and 10th rounds have an outside chance but probably won't make it. Players drafted after that are mostly meant to fill out a team's minor league rosters. Although this makes sense, I'm curious about players drafted in the middle to late rounds who not only make it to the majors, but end up having very good careers. The most obvious explanation would be the questions about health or signability drop a player down. However, there must also be other reasons. Are there examples where the scouting consensus on a player was simply wrong? Are these players from small schools or less populated parts of the country at a disadvantage? Are there other reasons for players falling through the cracks that I have not heard of? Then he goes on and talks about sandals for a while, but sandals are still stupid. Let's talk about guys who get drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Drafting is not an exact science. You can just look at any first round and know that. And these guys, when you draft them, be they 18 or 21, are far from finished products. Now, of course, the 1 through 5 guys, the guys you're going to pay a lot of attention to, you're going to be paying a lot of money for them. But when you're drafting in the 17th round, you really are taking a guy you think has a chance. You know he probably doesn't, but whoever is recommending that 17th round guy, the second baseman from Colorado, he sees something about him that at least gives him a chance. But there are guys who change completely, and there are guys. Here's a good one. Mitch Moreland. Mitch Moreland is the Rangers' first baseman. Mitch Moreland was a very late draft pick, and the reason the Texas Rangers drafted him is because they liked what they saw from him in some very, very brief mound experiences, and they wanted to make him a reliever, power arm off the mound. They signed Moreland. Moreland was very resistant to them, and they didn't want to force it. Moreland said, I can hit. Let me prove it to you. I can hit. And they decided basically to give Moreland a year that, and they said, we'll let him play a year, and he wants to prove he can hit. So theoretically, he'll play a year, he'll suck, and then he'll agree to go to the mound and do so in a more positive light. He'll be willing to do it. He'll be open to doing it to save his career. And instead, he just kept hitting, and now he's in the big leagues.
Sure. Yeah, I saw him. He had a pretty good 08 season at the plate, and then at the Instructional League in 08, he was working out of the bullpen.
Right.
And I remember he wasn't very happy about it because, I mean, here's a guy who in college, I mean, wasn't a great hitter, but he had good power potential. I mean, there was something in the swing, but there were a lot of holes in the swing. People didn't think he was going to play even above double A, and he just kept hitting, and he proved everybody wrong. I don't know how many people actually thought that he was going to be even a second division major league regular at
Zero.
The plate. I don't think anybody in the organization
the Texas
thought
Rangers.
That. Right.
I mean, that's the thing you got to remember about that. It's not just that. Not even the Rangers thought Mitch Moreland would be an everyday player, at least as a hitter. He was a
at least early on, yeah.
Right. I mean, he was a two-way guy at Mississippi State, and so he did come out of the bullpen for them, and that's what they liked. He's a 17th round pick, and a lot of it's attributed to a makeup. That's a big makeup kid. I mean, that is a crazy hard worker, and here we are. So there's plenty of guys that are wrong, but yeah, you're. Look, plenty of guys drafted in the 20s or 30s are going to make it to the big leagues. It's like a single-digit percentage. It's tiny, tiny percentage, but they make it, and because you end up being wrong about guys.
Sure, I mean, I think that basic construct is right, though, for the most part, about guys in the first five rounds.
It is, right, but there are exceptions to every rule.
Sure.
Our next email comes from Hudson. Hudson's in Blairstown, New Jersey. Hudson says, on episode 60, you guys responded to my email when I asked you to teach me the nuances of scouting. You told me to go to a minor league game every day for the rest of the season and to try to sit behind home plate. For the most part, I took your advice. I'm off to college in a few days, and I won't be able to make it to 30 games in 30 days, but I've been to about 15 to 20 games since episode 60. I have seen games in Lehigh Valley, Scranton, Reading, Trenton, Lakewood, Staten Island, Brooklyn, and Tri-City. Bought myself a pretty good stopwatch. I've twice had scouts ask me what I got for certain things, once a pop time on a catcher and once a time out of the box on first on Anthony Gose, who is just ridiculous. I got to talking to one scout about pitcher deliveries, and I learned a lot. I've been driving an insane amount and catching up on old podcasts while doing so. The other day, I was on my way to Staten Island to see them play low when I felt my stomach start to rumble. By some chance, I ended up pulling into a McDonald's and using the bathroom there, which was truly a horrible experience. See, he covered that even. My experience is coming to a close. I'll soon be off to college, but I want to thank you guys for opening my eyes to the process. I realize that this isn't glamorous, and the odds are I won't make a penny doing it, but scouting is awesome. And to put the professor's words more delicately, I'm still physically excited about scouting. Hudson, you're the best. And we've heard from other people. Dave Gershman has gone to, like, a game every day, basically, summer. And, you know, awesome. Take advantage of your energy, children. I think it's great. I think it's the best thing you can do for your – if this is what you want to do, that's the best thing you can do. And you're doing it the right way right now by going to games, sitting behind home plate and talking to people. So, you know, rock on, Hudson and Dave, and let us know how things work out. Next email is from Peter. Peter says, hello from New Zealand, as the international feel for the show continues. I know I'm not the first from New Zealand to write into you. No, you are not, which means we have multiple listeners in New Zealand. However, unlike my Kiwi predecessor, who I quote, surfs all day and relaxes at night with the podcast and a good Riesling, I have a job. I work in viticulture, and out on the vines, I have all the time in the world to enjoy your podcast. And thank you for the fabulous success that it is. Whether you two are talking about prospects, the arts, world affairs, Jorge, or just shooting the shit, you do it at a very high level, which says to me that you really respect your audience. I am not yet a point niner, but I am well on my way. But saying this brings me no joy. It seems to me that new listeners who race through the archive and finally achieve point niner status are like the elderly. Their best days are clearly behind them. And the weekly update becomes like the twice per year call from your grandkids you look so forward to. It's great while it lasts. But mainly it highlights how meaningless your life has become.
Oh, that's funny.
Thanks for all your hard work, Peter. And Peter has a little PS here. Kevin, you're absolutely right about the Beatles. I commend
you're
you
not for right about anything
to about your Beatlemania-stricken partner. While the Beatles were innovating new genres of rock and roll laziness and drag. That's a great term, rock and roll laziness. Musicians like John Coltrane, Cecil Taylor, Miles Davis were creating transcendent music that truly embodied the courage, intelligent heart, and elite musicianship of the era. I don't know who the greatest rock band in history is, but they sure as hell did not write Yellow Submarine. Back to the podcast. Time to talk about baseball briefly. Let's start with the fact that it's August 31st and it's going to be September in about 8.5 hours. And I was looking at some old agendas for podcasts that we did in September to see what we were talking about. And we had things to talk about. We had races and big games and series to talk about to get all excited about. We don't have those this year. And September's going to stink. I took a look at the Baseball Perspective playoff odds pages and did some math with them. And with a whole month to go in the season, around 30 games for most teams, the chances that the American League ends up, for lack of a better term, as is, so Red Sox, Yankees, Tigers, Rangers, is over 75%. The chances that the National League ends up as is, that being Phillies, Braves, Brewers, Diamondbacks, is 80%. So we what do we do for a month, Jason? We just kind of play off the string.
Well, we have to play out the string, and you hope for divisional races. You hope that the AL West, this will piss off Rangers fans, but you hope that the AL West becomes competitive, and at least down the stretch it becomes, really meaningful. You hope the same for the NL West. You hope the team like the Giants can make a big push.
The Giants made us.
Or can get a double. get more than one hit a game. That's what you hope.
The Giants did some house cleaning today. They got rid of Miguel Tejada and Aaron Rowand.
Yeah.
And the Rangers made some moves 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, they did.
And they picked up Matt Traynor and Michael Gonzalez to help them, even our lefty out of the pen. But
yeah, I'm not sure Traynor ever really left. I think he was just kind of with the Royals for a little while.
So, and Traynor gives them a solid backup catcher who's a great human being to have in the clubhouse. So, but with little things going on, as far as the win-loss standings, it's just hard to... Yeah, boy, I turn on my MLB TV at night and I go, which game to watch? And I'm like, none of these are really that compelling. There's all of a sudden a whole lot of talk about the MVP race.
There's too much talk about it.
There is, but let's talk about it anyway. We got an email. It says, Kevin and Jason, I know MVP arguments are generally frustrating and usually pointless until the end of the year, but nevertheless, I enjoy them immensely. The other day on Twitter was especially fun when everyone was riled up about the prospect of Justin Verlander as this year's AL MVP. In the midst of the discussion was a very distinct preface, shared by everyone it seems, that pitchers, especially starting pitchers, should not really be considered because they don't play in anywhere near the number of games a position player does. That argument makes a lot of sense and therefore is accepted without question, but shouldn't it be questioned at least somewhat? Yes, it should. In a given game, a starting pitcher that would be good enough to even be considered for MVP would pitch an average of 8 innings or 24 outs and allow around 4 base runners on average, meaning he was involved in around 28 plate appearances as a pitcher, another couple plays fielding, another 3 or so as a hitter if he's in the National League. In the same game, most position players will get around 5 plate appearances. And the point is, yes, a good starting pitcher is going to pitch to over 1,000 hitters in a year. And so now we're in a situation where they are involved in just as much as an everyday position player. But, there's a lot of talk about – here's the talk when people talk about the AL. You talk about Jose Bautista, and there's people who think, well, Jose Bautista is having the best year. Jose Bautista has the best numbers. He has been the most productive on, any sort of single number kind of thing, be it warp or war, B war, F war, K war, or any of those.
K-war.
Whatever. That's one of the great problems with the statistical movement. There's just too many of these things at times. And so he's been the best player. And look, there's no question in him. He leads the league in on-base percentage and slugging, which are, two of your finer measurements, and he leads in both of them. He's been the best player. Of course, his team does not have a winning record, nor is in the playoff hunt. Justin Verlander's been the best pitcher and almost a historically good pitcher for a team that is going to be in the playoffs that would be dead in the water without him. And then, of course, there's plenty of offensive guys you can think about, be it Granderson or Adrian Gonzalez or et cetera. So, if let's just say the baseball writers gave you a vote, Jason, what's important to you?
I mean, I guess all those things. I don't – first of all, I don't really care. I guess it matters – as far as a reward of having a great season. That said, I don't understand the hand-wringing about it. I don't understand the people who get so bent out of shape when, you say it has to come, a player has to come from a winning team, and then I don't understand the converse as well. I don't understand the argument that it has to come from a winning team, an MVP has to come from a winning team. From watching the games, from looking at the numbers, from looking at the standings, from looking at everything, I would have no problem if Bautista was the MVP. His numbers have been amazing. Toronto would not be in the position they're in without a guy like him in the middle of that lineup.
What
He has
position are they
been
in?
average. They would be below
I
average.
mean, that's here's.
Which I think that gets lost too. I mean, look, they're not a first place team, but without him in the lineup, they would be far worse than they are. More so than even the Tigers with Verlander. Now, here's something that'll piss people off. I think that there's an emotional component to a pitcher that a position player doesn't have. That pitcher takes the ball and takes them out and sets the tone for the game. When you have a pitcher like Verlander who can go out and dominate, I think it sets the tone for the team for the game. And I think that, a lot of people will disagree with that because it's not really, as quantifiable as other statistics. But I think that a guy like Verlander, if he were to win the MVP, I wouldn't have a problem with it because he's a pitcher inherently.
I would
I think that
actually,
he is.
Vote for Justin Verlander right now if I had to vote.
Understand what I'm talking about with the emotional
I do,
component,
I
how
do, I do.
it's not popular,
It's not, and I think it's totally,
it's real.
I don't, and I think it's wrong. And when I say wrong, I just mean in my opinion. I don't care if you think Bautista's the MVP. I totally get it. I
I
respect your
understand that too.
opinion.
Yeah, of
I'm
course.
totally fine with that. It's just it's not how I would do it. But here's here, let me ask you some hypotheticals here, because this is kind of fun. Let's say there was a reliever out there, right? And he went and he saved 70 games and never blew a save. He went 70 for 70 in saves, right? But his ERA was 3.5. A lot of one runs when he had a two run save situation. A lot of one runs or even two runs when he had a three run situation, but he never lost a game. Every time he was asked to do his job, he did his job. Would he be worth more than just his raw numbers?
Emotionally, yeah.
Okay, next
In
question.
actuality, no.
I think maybe in both ways. Yeah, here's my next question for you. Total theoretical. Obviously, this player could never exist. Let's say a guy hit 280 on the season, 280 with 20 home runs, good year, but not MVP numbers. But he hit 050 with the bases empty and 775 with runners in scoring position. He drove in 220 runs because he hit 775 with runners in scoring position, but never got a hit with the bases empty. Is he more valuable?
To the team, yes.
Yes. That's why I'm not a big fan of just saying, oh, best WAR or best OPS or best whatever one number you want to pick. That's the guy.
I think it's just a matter of maybe semantics, definition,
Yeah, sure.
what is the most valuable player
And
for
to
you?
be clear, if you've ever seen a ballot that they get, there's it's very it's wide open. They're not really there's no direction. It's just, AL MVP 1 through 10. There's no
It's however you
direction.
want to interpret it,
Right.
I mean, personally, if I'm looking at a team and it's my team, who's more valuable, the middle of the order hitter or the guy who can pitch game one of a World Series? I mean, that's a really, really tough question.
That's a fun one. So
It's a fun one, but I wouldn't have a problem. I am not going to be one of those people who I don't really give a shit, first of all, but who get up in arms if Verlander were to win because he doesn't have as many opportunities or whatever. He doesn't alter the game as much or whatever the argument happens to be. I
Right.
think Verlander's had a Cy Young season,
Easy.
and he should definitely be in the MVP discussion.
Yeah. And again, I don't if Bautista wins, I'm going to go, okay, that makes sense. If Verlander wins it, I'm going to go, oh, that makes sense. And if they want to give it to, I don't know, Curtis Granderson or someone, I'm going to go, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, but I don't like the argument that Bautista can't win it because the Jays are mediocre.
So
I don't like
you
that
so if a
argument.
guy really had a crazy year, let's say on the Houston Astros next year, the Houston Astros go 70-92.
They probably will.
But Jose Altuve hits 424 with 21 home runs.
Well, wouldn't that make him the best player in the league?
Was
The
that?
most valuable player in the league?
I'm asking you, so you would have no problem voting for Jose Altuve.
No, I don't give. I don't. I mean, look. you'd have to think if they won 72 games or whatever, what they wouldn't, how many games would they have won if Altuve didn't hit 420 or
But
whatever?
what's the difference between 72 and 54, really, if you're still, well, 35 games out?
That's, well, it's the same difference between winning 100 and winning 84 games or
Well,
85
no, because
games.
100 gets you in the postseason, the 84 doesn't.
And it's still that much, it's still affecting that many wins,
Yeah, no,
which
it is, but are
then it
those wins
means
important? But are
value.
those wins important?
Yes, they're important.
Okay.
Every win's important.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
You only get 162 games, every win's important.
Words of wisdom there.
Well, it's true. I mean, look, is it that, see, that seems to be the argument that you have to be on a you have to make it to the postseason for the wins to matter.
I kind
When
of
I
get
think
that argument. I don't totally agree with it, but
that's a very,
I do
that's a
kind of
very
get it.
nebulous argument.
I kind of get that argument though. Yeah, I think on the most base level, if you win, 83 games or 71 or 58, you didn't make the playoffs and it doesn't really matter.
For the team.
Right.
Well, I think it does matter if you didn't have one player on that team and you would have won 70 as a result. I think that player matters. If
Okay.
he brings that many wins to the table, which obviously that wouldn't, no one's going to have that sort of season. Altuve's not going to have that sort of season, but if Altuve were to have that sort of season and it did represent that much value in terms of wins to a team, I think he would in turn be the most valuable player in the league.
Maybe we'll do some sort of podcast awards. We'll see what our listeners think.
We should.
I need to find someone to tally those up because I'm not doing it. I know you're not.
No.
So this week, everyone got very excited last couple of days on Twitter because the Arizona Fall League rosters were announced. And the Arizona Fall League is incredibly exciting, and I love the Arizona Fall League, and Jason does too. And I think we're planning to get together at some point in Arizona and then go to fall league games. You can see so many good players. But I just want to do a little reality check here on a couple issues. The first thing was all sorts of questions I got about why isn't this guy in the Arizona Fall League roster? And the answer is because they don't want him there for some reason, or more importantly, because they have someone else they really need there.
It's not a futures game league.
It's
That's what people
exactly
need to know.
right. It's a developmental league, and there are guys you need. You want to get extra time. You want them to learn a new role. You want them to work on a specific aspect of their game. It is a developmental league. And so maybe your guy, they're happy with what he did this year. They just want him to go home and get some rest and stay healthy. And, most of the pitchers there are guys who have not pitched enough this year. And that's one of the things. It's not a pitching league. Almost every good pitching prospect's not there. Any good pitching prospect there didn't get enough innings this year, didn't hit his workload cap because he got injured at some point. And so it's a rough situation, and don't get too worked up about who's there and who's not. And also, I want to talk about Bryce Harper for a second because he's going there. But Bryce Harper has not ruined, but he's affected my life in a bad way because he's created like these weird expectations. Bryce Harper is a very unique player and one of the more unique players we've ever had. So when I get questions about, why aren't the Mets sending Brandon Nimmo to the Arizona Fall League? Why aren't the
Oh
Royals sending Bubba Starling to the Arizona Fall
God.
League?
Starling didn't, he's what, 18? He doesn't need to be in that league.
Bubba Starling would go 1-for-40 with 37 strikeouts in the Arizona Fall League.
It's an advanced league. I mean, that's where you send guys who you're thinking about putting on your 40-man roster next year. I mean,
Right.
guys who are going to possibly see major league action,
Right. And
you
that's who's
know.
going there. It's not, this is not for kids. This is not kids' place. These are advanced guys. And so just because Bryce Harper went there doesn't mean, everyone's teenage prospect can go there. 99.9% of those kids would get walloped in this league. They would get
Right.
crushed. And even with the lesser pitching. And the other thing is the lesser pitching is going to create some unreal expectations. And whenever you get excited about how well some guy does in the Arizona Fall League. Just remember how that the Arizona Fall League record book is littered with names like Scott Pose and Ken Harvey and Tag Bozide and Brandon Wood and guys who we all everyone got very, very excited about, and then it didn't work out so well. And so it's a situation where it's such a small amount of time in a very offensive environment with bad pitching. And it's the worst thing in the world. I mean, the best who crushed it in the Arizona Fall League last year. I mean, Ackley was great, but you know,
Angel Beltre crushed it.
Juan Linares was great. Mike McDade was fantastic. Charlie Culberson was really good. Connor Gillespie and Adam Lowen led the league in home runs. It's time to come. Neil Shank was one of the best pitchers. Eric Hurley was one of the best pitchers.
I mean, it's definitely good to you want the players you send in there who
to do well.
Who either on the you want them to do well. Players on the bubble, you know, it's a good way of you know, there a lot of players who get sent there are coming up for Rule 5 eligibility in the offseason, and it's a good way for not only the you know the parent team to evaluate that player to see whether that player is going to be included in the Rule 5. It's also a good opportunity for other teams to get a look at that player against you know, good competition.
Oh, scouts love going there because you can see 12 guys in one game that you care about.
Right. It's good for scouts, but as far as like looking at the numbers go, it can be very, very misleading. So, very misleading. Yeah.
So the Arizona Fall League starts in October, and we're going to try to figure some time when we're there together, and maybe we'll do something with the listeners.
Yeah, I'll be out there twice. I think I'm going to go out there for the instructional league, and then I'm going to go back out for the AFO.
So, and we'll figure something out from there. So that's our very brief baseball talk because September is going to be boring, folks. So yeah. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to our good friend Juan C. Rodriguez with the Sun Sentinel about Marlins past, present, and future. And then we'll do the goofy stuff, so stick around. Special guest time. Our guest is a longtime beat writer for the Florida Marlins, and he's joining us from his palatial hotel room in New York as he covers the Marlins at the Mets. It's Juan C. Rodriguez. Juan, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Now, well, let's get to this. Let's get right to this. Are you really doing great? As it's, you know, the stretch run of the season, we're in the last month, you're covering the Marlins and you're in New York covering a Marlins-Mets series.
I tell you, it seems like it's more like I'm in my seventh month of covering this year as opposed to the fifth. But you know, you factor in the weather and postponements and how little they've played recently. It does seem like you know, we've added some bonus time to this year, and not in a positive way.
Is it frustrating being the Marlins beat writer? Is it frustrating going to home games and realizing at times there might be more people in the press box than the game?
You know, what's frustrating, I guess, is just, you know, when the team is struggling like it is, and I think it's, you can probably say this for any sports market, you know, the team just loses relevance. And, you know, baseball isn't exactly king in South Florida to begin with, so it doesn't take a lot for, you know, fans to tune out the Marlins, especially when things are going as bad as they have so far. So, you know, it becomes a little frustrating from that standpoint. But, you know, at the same time, when I start thinking that way, you know, consider some of my colleagues around the league, whether it be in Pittsburgh or Kansas City, where they've kind of had to deal with situations like this year in and year out. And you know, I'm kind of thankful that at least, you know, for the most part, the Marlins have been able to put, you know, some compelling product on the field, you know, despite their payroll limitations. But, you know, I don't think anybody could have envisioned just how poorly this season has gone, especially considering all the talk about the, you know, the momentum that they hope to build going into that new ballpark next season.
Now, all their hopes seem to be into this new ballpark, which is in Little Havana. There's going to be an accompanying name change with this. And are you buying this as this is the beginning of a turnaround for Marlins baseball? Are you buying that this could be something that kind of changes the face of the franchise, or Are we at a point where you have to question whether baseball is sustainable in Miami?
Well, it really has to. I mean, this is, the piece that everybody has said for so long has been missing as far as, baseball working down there. And, from the standpoint of just, the fan experience and, the comfort of going to a Marlin game now, it's got to help. The weather is obviously a huge factor down there. And then, yes, it's hot in Florida and it's hot in a million other places and fans still come out. But, I've sat out there in those seats, for night games in the middle of summer. The humidity is unbearable and, it's just uncomfortable to be there. It's almost better to just stay home and watch games on TV. And I think, most fans do that. The Marlins tend to get very good TV ratings. And I think, the fact that the stadium experience is so poor probably has something to do with that. But I don't think it's a slam dunk, just because they have a new stadium that this franchise is going to bloom. It will open up new opportunities for them just in terms of, the revenue streams that are going to be available to them now that's going to enable them to maybe keep some of these, good young players that they work so hard to develop that, once they get, deep into their arbitration years or into free agency, they just they can't keep anymore. But I think now with this new stadium, you can envision a Mike Stanton being a Marlin for 10-plus years. You can envision, Josh Johnson, being the face of the franchise for a good long while. So, I think that's what it'll enable them to do. But, at the same time, they're in a different location. They're going to have to tap a bit of a different market, I think, more of that Miami market, more of that South Miami-Dade County market, as opposed to where Sun Life Stadium is. And for all, the negatives there, the location certainly wasn't one of them. It's right on the Miami-Dade-Broward County line and really in a great place just to draw from all three counties, going up to Palm Beach even. But, I think the fact that you're going to get, 9 innings now of uninterrupted baseball, might be enough to get some fans to drive a little extra time to get down there, just knowing that they're going to have a better experience.
You said something in there that really surprised me. The Marlins do well as far as television goes.
Yeah, I think this year the ratings might be down as opposed to more recent years, but for the most part they've been doing very well as far as television ratings over the last few years. They get a lot of strong single game performances, and I think over the course of the season they're probably in the top or at least they have been the last few years as far as TV ratings.
Wow. So maybe it really is just the stadium. So the team does have, even though nobody goes, the team does have some sort of footprint in Miami.
Yeah, and my personal theory on this is I think one of the one reason why everybody thought baseball would really do well down in South Florida is just the Cuban community, right? And the passion that the Cubans and the Latin Americans have for baseball, that it would really flourish down there. And I think the older generation of Cubans, at least many that I know, they watch the Marlins faithfully on TV. I mean, come 7 o'clock, the TV is tuned to the Marlins. I mean, they don't necessarily go out to games and the numbers and maybe the Marlins hope they would, but I think they're very faithful watchers, and I think that factors into that equation.
Obviously, we've seen all the photos of the stadium being half empty, and and then we see the official attendance being 22,000. Is there a sense for what the real attendance is of some of these games, and what what the team's really kind of averaging on a real world level as far as actual butts in the seats?
Yeah, it's tough to say. Obviously, the attendance that that we're given and is announced at every baseball game is tickets sold, and obviously that doesn't correlate with bodies in the seats, as you say. They kind of made some national news the other day with the first game of a doubleheader against the Reds, where somebody said they had like 347 people at the stadium come first pitch, but whether that number was accurate or not, who knows? And I'm willing to bet that for a you know, an unscheduled game like that that was you know, added at the last minute, obviously just the Marlins were trying to avoid you know, weather situation with Hurricane Irene on Sunday, so they added that extra game. You know, actually it was a midweek game, so you know, you factor in a mid-afternoon game, midweek, school had already started. You know, I don't think a game like that is going to draw particularly well in too many, you know, markets, you know, around the country. And then, you know, just factor in, you know, the Marlins, you know, don't draw well to begin with. You know, you get, you know, kind of numbers like you know, you saw publicized. So, you know, it's a difficult situation, but obviously everybody's anticipating that the stadium is going to, new stadium's going to remedy that to a big extent.
Let's talk about the new stadium for a bit. I mean, I know it's planned to be there for opening day, and this was a somewhat publicly financed stadium, correct?
Yes, it was financed by the city of Miami and Miami-Dade County,
and
as well as the Marlins.
And there were some controversies during the financing as far as Loria's the team financials getting out and. It's showing that there was, you know, they were making maybe a little bit more money than they said they were going in.
Yeah, that definitely, I think, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way when those numbers came out. You know, there was a sense that maybe the Marlins should have contributed more to the construction cost of the stadium. You know, I think a lot of people looked at it as, you know, the Marlins getting a sweetheart deal and you know, maybe taking the city and the county to the cleaners to a certain extent. And you know, there were some commissioners that did a lot of grandstanding about you know, reviewing the whole thing, which obviously you know, by that time it was too late to do anything. You know, it also comes just with the fact that there's you know, this ownership group you know, hasn't you know, endeared too many fans. You know, even after winning that World Series in 2003, you know, they had you know, in 2006 they completely pared down you know, payroll and I think everything they do is just looked at with a certain degree of skepticism. And you know, I'm not sure what they can do to you know, alleviate that besides just you know, fulfilling their promise to you know, have a more representative payroll. You know, team president David Sampson's been on the record saying that once they get into that new ballpark, you know, they anticipate having a middle of the road payroll, which, you know, these days in Major League Baseball is probably, you know, $85, $90, $95 million. So you know, it should be interesting to see what this you know, front office could do with those kinds of resources at their disposal. But you know, this ownership group has some work to do, and I think it'll be a process to win over fans and you know, getting the stadium up and making sure that that the Marlins are competitive for many years to come is a big step toward that end.
I mean, you talked about how, you know, they've done a great job, actually, you know, in developing and trading for drafting and developing young talents, a young team with guys they want to keep. And but I mean, you mentioned that, you know, they wanted to use this team as kind of, this year rather, as kind of a stepping stone or a step in the right direction. They move into this new stadium, but a lot of things have gone really, really bad this year, both kind of on a player level and on a PR level. Let's start with this, the player level stuff, and obviously you have injuries and things that are going on there. But what the heck's happened to Hanley Ramirez this year?
Boy, that's kind of a $64,000 question. You know, he got off to a very poor start in the season, and you know, had one DL stint earlier when his back started barking on him a little bit. He was out for 2 weeks, and you know, then he came back and started turning it up a little bit, and you know, got his average up into the 240 range after being, you know, around 200 for most of the year, and you know, really just hasn't shown any kind of signs of being the player that he's been in the past. You know, the former National League batting champion, just not driving the ball the way he used to, and you know, it's been kind of a mystery as to, you know, why he hasn't done that. You know, his fly ball rates have kind of really plummeted over the last year and a half. You know, he's just not getting balls in the air, not driving balls to the ballpark the way we're used to seeing. And, you know, now he's been out for probably a good month with a shoulder strain that he suffered going after a ball, a little pop fly into short left the last time the Marlins were in New York here. And he's on a rehab assignment right now. And looks like he'll be activated as soon as, you know, rosters can expand now on the 1st of November. So, you know, let's see what, you know, he can do the last month of the season. It's probably a pretty important month for him just to kind of get himself, you know, back on track and at least, you know, go into next season, you know, knowing that he's healthy and can strike the ball the way he's used to doing so.
And obviously Ramirez gives them, if he's healthy, you know, a superstar that can that they can get people excited. But, you know, the Marlins had another guy who looked like he might be becoming one of those players, and then he had a great first part of the season, then he went into a slump, and then he got sent down for reasons that may or may not have been performance related. You know, what was your take on the whole Logan Morrison thing?
You know, I was surprised that he was sent down, and you look at his numbers, and you can't argue with the fact that he was struggling and not performing to the way that he's done in the past and the way that they, you know, expect him to do for a kid with his talent. But, you know, certainly I have trouble believing that, you know, if the Marlins were winning and everything was peachy keen, that, you know, they would have sent him down. Obviously, you know, the fact that they were struggling kind of enabled them to send a little bit of a message. And you know, I think in Logan's case, he was probably getting a little bit more pressed for some off-field things than what he was doing on the field. And I think that, you know, started rubbing the Marlins the wrong way. So, you know, I think it was, you know, a message not only to Logan, but to the rest of these young guys. Hey, don't get too comfortable up here. You know, obviously, you know, they're here now, and everybody knows that, you know, a lot of these guys are kind of keystone pieces, you know, moving forward for this organization. But, you know, they don't want anybody feeling, you know, too comfortable. And then bottom line is they want everybody's head, you know, in the game. And, you know, for whatever reason, they felt, you know, Logan just wasn't devoting the kind of attention to his performance that he needed. And, you know, he's the first one to tell you that the SC had been struggling and hadn't been doing well, but he hadn't changed anything as far as his Twitter habits or things along those lines from when he was hitting 320 earlier in the season to now. So, you know, I'm not sure that he sees the correlation. And, you know, if you sit him down and ask him now, do you know why you were sitting down? He probably wouldn't have a very good answer for you. So, you know, whether or not this helps him in the long run, we'll see. But, you know, one thing is for sure, that this kid is, you know, has way more talent than what his numbers show right now. And, you know, for the Marlins' sake, you know, he really needs to put things together going forward.
And what do you think about his off-the-field antics and all the Twitter and everything?
You know, I mean, I don't see every single tweet he puts out there, but, you know, I think for the most part, he just has fun with it. You know, I think in a lot of cases, he just uses it as a, you know, as a tool for some of his charity work and to get, you know, message out about certain things. He's very active in, you know, the American Lung Association, and, you know, after losing his dad to lung cancer, he kind of, you know, took up that mantle. So, you know, I think that was one big reason why he got into, Twitter as heavily as he did. But you know, he has fun with it, and he goes back and forth with fans. I mean, I haven't, you know, like I said, seen anything out there that I found necessarily offensive, you know, or anything like that. But you know, outside of the Twitter thing, there are probably some you know, some issues inside the clubhouse that maybe contributed to him getting sent down too. I mean, I think Logan in the long run is going to be a great leader for this team, and he's just, you know, naturally outspoken, and maybe he said things that were out of place for a guy with his service time, you know, at different points during the season, especially for a guy who's, you know, been struggling lately as much as he has. So, you know, I think this was probably, you know, the Marlins, the best way they felt like they can, you know, get the message across that, you know, in his situation, it's probably better to be seen and not heard as much.
In the end, I mean, do you think, what are your odds here as far as the stadium for lack of a better term, saving the Marlins. I mean, is this obviously they have to perform well. That'll play a big role here. But can baseball work in Miami? I mean, can the stadium be the beginning of something to make baseball work in Miami? And does baseball work in Florida, period, considering the Rays struggles?
Well, you know, I think there's something to be said about, you know, that excitement that you have for spring training everywhere else around the country. You don't have it down here in Florida because really the team is down here year-round, and, you know, there's nowhere for Marlin fans to go on a, you know, spring trip to get out of the cold and get excited about baseball. You know, they're already down here, and you know, when the Marlins have their spring training up in Jupiter in North Palm Beach County, and it's basically a, you know, an hour and a quarter drive from the, you know, Dade Broward County line. So, you know, I think from that aspect, it it hurts a little bit, but you know, the stadium will definitely help initially. You know, I think it's really going to be a wonderful facility. You know, I've had a chance to tour it a couple of times, you know, when the Marlins have taken the media out there, and it really looks like it's going to be a special building. And, you know, with that building, I think there's also the anticipation of, you know, getting some of the jewel events down here, and whether it be All-Star Games, and, you know, there's talk about maybe a little baseball classic final in the future. So, you know, getting those events down here, I think, will help as well. But, you know, as you know, this country is full of just gorgeous ballparks that don't fill up just because of the, you know, the product on the field.
Right.
You know, PNC is a perfect example. You know, probably one of my you know, top three ballparks. And, you know, how long did we, you know, see that stadium empty just because of the Pirates struggle? So I think that situation, you know, certainly can happen in Florida, you know, if the Marlins can't find a way to compete in the National League East. But, you know, initially I think the ballpark will definitely give this franchise a much-needed boost, but ultimately whether they win or not is what's going to determine if they sustain it.
Well, Juan, I want to thank you for joining us. I know you got a huge game tonight with Javier Vasquez and Mike Pelfrey on the mound in New York.
Huge. All kinds of implications.
It's the battle for something, right? Is there a trophy involved here?
I don't know. There probably should be, considering how these two teams have gone this year. But I think we're just playing out the string as we speak here.
We'll keep playing out the string. And if you want to read Ron, you can check him out at The Sentinel, or you can follow him on Twitter at
JCR Marlins.
JCR Marlins. Thanks for coming on.
You got it, Kevin. Anytime.
Thanks, man. Welcome back to our brief episode 64. It's a little shorter. We had some issues, both timing-wise, tactical-wise, but we're here. We're doing a show, damn it. Our musical guest this week is Big Eyes, and Big Eyes is our good friend. Comes from our good friends at Don Giovanni Records. Their new album, Hard Life, is out. It came out 2 weeks ago on August 16th. You can get it on iTunes and all your general places. Outstanding band, straight ahead, rock and roll, power, rock, pop, punk kind of sound, from Brooklyn, New York. And when we thank them, and they're touring right now. And so if you want to go see them, you can do so. They just finished up kind of the East Coast part of the tour. And this is, you know, this is a small band doing the whole, you know, DIY tour thing. So you got
to
respect
them. Very hard to do nowadays.
Absolutely. They just finished up the Midwest. They're actually going to be playing Milwaukee tonight on Wednesday. Then they go to Minneapolis. I'm laughing because they have lots of really good name bands opening for them. So they're playing in Minneapolis on Thursday. Opening for them is the Miami Dolphins.
That's original.
On Friday, they're playing the Aquarium in Fargo, North Dakota. Opening for them is Fuck Detector. It's just
That's
great.
a hard detector. It's hard to recognize. Are they fucking? I don't know. I need my fuck detector.
On Sunday,
they look like they're fucking.
On Sunday, they're playing Bozeman, Montana with the Getting Up Early Boys. They're playing with outstanding named bands, but of course they're the big shots. They're the headliners. And later in the month, they'll be in Washington as well, playing Spokane, Seattle, and then they'll hit Portland, Olympia, Bellingham, and do the whole Pacific Northwest thing. But Big Eyes, thanks to them for letting us play their music. Thanks to John Giovanni Records for getting them all set with us. Now, it is Wednesday at 3.02 p.m., so I'm not going to ask you what you're drinking. Look, we're recording this one during the day. Night drinking just is the only thing we do. Well, which is a weird thing. You know, what are you drinking at 3 o'clock is not going to work very well, even though there was recently a Twitter discussion over how good a drunk Jason is, in which our former podcast guest Amanda Rykoff called you a world-class drunk.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't tell.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. I mean, if that was a good thing or a bad thing, knowing her, I think she thinks it's a good thing. So that's a that is a good thing. I know Jorge prides himself on his skill with the drink.
He's a different kind of drunk. He's very calm and then steals people's taxi cabs.
Right. Yeah, he'll get you when you're not looking. I tend to just escalate and get louder and more aggressive.
So Jason, you're in Mexico.
Yeah.
How are things
I'm
in
gonna
Mexico?
Be.
And then well, there goes little... my phone. I can't do anything about that.
Oh, the nice ring.
It's nice, isn't it? I can't do it. Enjoy that, people. There's really nothing I can do about it. So,
yeah, I'm in Mexico. I'm a little under the weather today.
Well, now you're in Mexico. You're in a foreign country. At some point, some sort of foreign body has entered your system, and your body has not reacted to it kindly.
Yeah, I mean, it usually happens.
This comes to the territory.
Well, actually, it's never not happened, I should
right.
say. I get some sort of bacterial infection from some source. It's hard to pinpoint where it comes from. Usually it happens within the first couple of days of me being here. This time it took, 8 or 9 days before it set in. But I don't know what happened. It's just it's uncomfortable. Obviously, and then we had the power go out the other night and it was kind of muggy and, I'm just not feeling well and there's no electricity. It's just kind of wow.
Good things happen in Mexico
water.
This week?
Did things happen?
Did good things happen for you?
Yeah. I mean, I had a really good time on Saturday night. I went to, went out to Xochimilco, the canals, and, just got, blackout drunk on the boats, which was kind of fun. just drinking tequila while some guy takes me around the canals. We had a big party of people and we were just tons of drinking. Mariachis, they'll pull up in a boat and tie on and just play right in front of you, and then other people will pull up and cook food for you on giant comals. And that's a cool experience. And then reality came back in, because I've been here working, so I've been trying to work. I haven't been able to work today because I haven't been feeling very well.
And then,
no, but Mexico is very exciting.
And you, what you got other stuff going on this week? You're gonna be seeing our good friend Juan.
Yeah, I'm gonna get together with Juan on Saturday, hopefully, in either Roma or Condesa, and I hope he comes to Condesa because I want to take him to this this Khalifa, this taco place that I really really like.
Is it named after Sammy Khalifa?
Yeah, it is. Get into some Victoria, get into some beers. I hope I'm feeling better by then, because the last thing I want to do right now is drink beer.
And this is a good taco place.
This is the best taco place I've ever been to, I think.
And if you've never been to Mexico, have you never really had a taco?
There are good tacos out there. I mean,
what
this
makes
just happens
this place
to be
so
my
special?
Favorite. It's kind of hard to describe. I mean, the environment is really unique. It's really, really bright inside, and there's it's a complete turnoff aesthetically as you would normally, function in an eating environment. They're playing loud music. It's really bright. It's always fucking overcrowded. It's got everything that you would walk away from in a restaurant normally, but Food is so amazing. It gives you that kind of, you can't really describe it. It's just that warm, kind of comforted feeling when you're done eating that it makes you feel like almost like a little kid, like you're content. And you don't get that from a lot of different places, or most places, I should say. And this place certainly makes you feel like, like you did something right by sitting down and putting up with the loud dance music or whatever the hell. I watched the Rangers, the Rangers Angels game in there the other night, which was kind of interesting.
Now, if I walked in there with you would tell me, okay, Kevin, you gotta have the.
I'd say you have to have the I mean they're known for like their chicharrón de queso,
Ooh.
which is just what it sounds like. It's everything there like comes on one plate, and it's like either tacos al pastor, which is really good, that they cut it right there, and then they just stack them on top of the plate, so you just have multiple tacos stacked on top, and you can do whatever the fuck you want with them. The chicharrones are really really good there. Yeah, I mean everything's really good there. They have like even like their consommé soups, just like their jugo de carne is really really good. I mean it's perfect hangover food.
Right.
So yeah, and when you come down here, I'll take you there. It's really really good, and I'm gonna hopefully take Juan there.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's good. I just hope I'm feeling better by then. It's not exactly the type of environment I want to be in right now.
So, do you have baseball stuff going on this week?
Yeah, I have writing to do. I'm working on stuff for BP, like out the ass. And I just I'm almost finished with like something for Texas Farm Review about the Rangers contingent to the AFL, and how they're sending eight players, and three of which are kind of warm bodies.
That's probably a little, I would bet most teams are sending half warm bodies. And the other thing, something we didn't bring up in our AFL talk is just that when you get all worked up about the rosters, that's cool and all, but understand that between now and opening day, which is something around 6 weeks from now, those rosters change immensely. Probably they'll be 20% different than what they are right now.
Yeah, I agree,
I mean, right
and
now, Mike
there's like,
Trout's on an Arizona Fall League roster, and he's on the same team with Bryce Harper, and that is fucking cool. But you know what? I bet you good money Mike Trout doesn't play in the Arizona Fall League this year.
yeah, I bet you that as well. And you don't know how players are going to finish out their campaigns. They may tweak something. They may, it may not be in their best interest to go to the Arizona Fall League. They may end up going to a Caribbean league. They may end up going to the Fall Instructional League. It just depends. I mean, the
Yeah.
Rangers are sending like Mike Ault, who was a guy who got injured,
That's, see, that's a
missed
great
most of the.
sign. I mean, it's a guy you want to get more at bats and you can test him against a higher level. Perfect Arizona Fall League guy.
Yeah, same with Neil Ramirez, a guy who
Perfect.
had just a really breakout year, but only pitched like 90 innings, probably be 100 innings by the end of the season. A guy that he had some injuries, and you want to see him log some more innings, more time. And then they're sending some warm bodies as well. So, I mean, I'm trying to let people know that just because, Ryan Kelly or Sarmiento or, any of the other filler guys aren't, super prospects. They're players who can fill a role,
Right.
but what are you working on?
Well, I just, we always talk about my ESPN piece. That went up today, and then basically I talked about they're doing kind of a whole series of free agent things over at ESPN, kind of a free agency preview. And so I wrote about the potential free agents and guys who, if they leave, what happens, like who are the prospects who get opportunities this way. And so, if Milwaukee loses Prince Fielder, what do we get? If St. Louis loses Albert Pujols, what do we get? And then could we be in a position where we're close to getting for the first time in a long time, a bit of a youth movement in the Bronx with guys like Montero, Banuelos, Betances, things like that. And so it's just
That would
kind
be
of
great.
a summary of that kind of stuff.
Excellent. I'll have to read it.
And I'll be doing some Arizona Fall League stuff, I think, later in the week. And then minor league season ends on Monday.
Yeah.
For the there's one league, I think it's the Pioneer League, that goes a little few extra days.
It's
But
kind of sad.
it's sad. Many of the short season leagues have already ended.
Yes.
The Gulf Coast League has already finished their playoffs. The Appy League playoffs start, I believe, today, if not tomorrow. And so it's we're getting we're done. We're almost over. We have very few games left to go
One last
to.
push.
It's
One
very.
last weekend.
I'm depressed and sad, and my number of box scores will reduce greatly on a nightly basis. And it's over, folks. And then, so what we have to do in September is we'll start wrapping things up, and seeing who did what, and whose stock went up, whose stock went down, and crap like that. So until then, Jason, go rest.
I will.
And have a good time. We'll talk next week with more Tales from Mexico and Tales of Juan.
I'll have a in-person Tales of Juan.
A whole lot of Juan on this show.
Tons of Juan. Tons of want.
And thanks for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.